Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers Charity. In this edition of General Talk, we focus on the role of the millions of women who so selflessly stepped the mark, put their shoulder to the wheel, and played a key part in the defeat of the Axis powers in the Second World War. Their involvement was vital to the Allied victory achieved in 1945, yet their story is so often overlooked. Women remain the unsung heroes of the war effort. My guest for this programme is Joyce Wilding, who volunteered for the First Aid Nursing Yeomanry, or FANY, in 1943, serving as part of Churchill's Private Army, the Special Operations Executive, or SOE, ministering to the many needs of agents as they prepared for highly dangerous missions deep behind enemy lines, assisting local resistance groups or bands of partisans in the overthrow of Nazi Germany. Sharp, engaging, and with an infectious enthusiasm for life, at 97 years old, Joyce is not only the epitome of the stoicism, determination, and courage so readily associated with that greatest generation who defended our shores against tyranny's threat, but also a reminder of the enormous debt we owe to the brave women who today now serve in the very front line. The equal of their male comrades, their presence lending an exciting new dimension, no doubt raising the bar considerably, making our armed forces fairer, better, and all the more capable. It was my great privilege to meet Joyce over a cup of tea in her sitting room at home. I hope you enjoy the programme.
I'd like to start at the beginning, if I may.
Yes.
And take you back to your school days.
Yes.
You were at school. Where were you at school?
At a small private school called the Manor House at Limpsfield. It was really put on the map because the Churchill daughters were all there, because Westrum was quite near Limpsfield.
Churchill then was, of course, in the wilderness. Neville Chamberlain was
yes.
Prime Minister.
My maiden name was Chamberlain. And she was Churchill. So in some ways, neither of us were particularly popular at different, you know, times. But she was a lovely person, and but a couple of years older than me, so I wasn't in her class, yeah. Played tennis with her.
In those pre-war years, 1937-38, did you feel the tension of Nazi Germany threatening over you?
I think we felt the war was coming because my father was in the First World War and my mother lost a brother, and I was brought up very much under the cloud of the First World War, not allowed German toys. You know, so many friends were widowed, you know, because... Well, the losses were enormous, weren't
yes,
they?
Yes, huge, yes, yes. The Auxiliary Territorial Service had been formed in 1938, I think, but the FANY, the First Aid Nursing Yeomanry, now Princess Royal's Volunteer Corps, was formed in 1907. It was a volunteer, yes. It was a volunteer corps.
Absolutely, and they were really mainly ambulance drivers in the First World War. Mm.
And if I recollect, the whole reason you wanted to join the FANY was so that you could get your driving licence.
Well, so I could drive. I did a crash course at the British School of Motoring before we went up to be interviewed, because I was doing this with a school friend, and the idea was to be a driver because it sounded, to be honest, more interesting and glamorous in a way than, you know, sitting at a desk. But I have never taken a driving test. I had to take one. I think they tested me in the FANYs before I got moved on to be a driver, because they couldn't send me somewhere if I couldn't drive.
But it would be 4 years before you properly got behind the wheel, wasn't it?
Yes.
was at a point of some frustration?
Yes, but of course I drove at home, you know. Really, my father taught me, and we just drove, you know, locally. I suppose one was allowed to drive. I don't think I had an L plate on or anything like that. Right. It was not automatic. Double D clutching.
Double D clutching and no power steering.
No.
But to be behind the wheel, what was the feeling like being behind the wheel?
Oh, I love it now. Yeah. You know, absolutely. It's a sort of form of freedom, nearly, being independent. I mean, I think if I couldn't drive, that really would be the end.
But, well, let's hope you stay on the road for some time.
Well, I have a licence up to 2024.
Good.
Well, my son keeps telling me I can't have a new car because I won't know how it works. I've got a hybrid at the moment. So I said, you can't stop me driving at the minute.
When the outbreak of war happened on September 1939, what was your feeling when you heard Neville Chamberlain come on the radio?
It was a terrible one. Listen to those awful broadcasts. You know, he kept coming back from Munich. And I remember being in the field on my horse, and my father coming out and saying we were at war. You know, it was the most extraordinary feeling, really. And it began to be quite worrying. But it was the end of normal life, nearly.
Why the family were over 8 years as a matter of interest?
Well, I think somehow we found out they were recruiting. And I'm not quite sure how, but it must have been either through a friend that had joined or something like that. And this school friend and I just went to headquarters at Wilton Place in London, and there were really rather frightening fannies because it was just like going back to school interviewed. But, you know, they were very happy as long as one realised that security for what they were recruiting for, a special group, they never said why yet, but we had to give two references. And when they were cleared, we were re-interviewed again.
And may I ask, and who were your references? Who were your referees?
The local doctor and the bank manager, because my father had just started me a bank account. And they obviously thought it was whatever questions they were asked, they answered okay.
And on the network, somehow you've been tipped the wink, there was a special role going within the fannies. What did you know of that special role?
We didn't know. We only knew that it was a group. It wasn't driving. It wasn't British Red Cross, because really we thought the fannies are mainly Red Cross, you see, and or nurses, something like that. They didn't tell us, but we were sent to Banbury, Overthorpe Hall, where one did about 10 days, fortnight's training. There was a certain amount of PE, you know, and we did a route march. But mainly it was talks from army folk that came down from London to really install in us that one literally must not disclose anything.
Did you feel a great sense of teamwork that you were putting together to help?
Yes, I remember I felt really quite important, you know, because here I was going to do something and I mustn't tell anybody, which is, you know, quite difficult in a way.
And did your parents know what you were doing?
Never.
What did you tell your parents?
They were given cover stories. We were at an overseas special training school. They were all called STS, the number. And for overseas forces. They were all overseas forces, and this was a wireless training school.
What was your impression when you first joined? Once you passed out of your training, and here you are, you went to work. Your first appointment was as a transmitter hut attendant.
Yes,
it didn't sound very glamorous, did it?
No, we were told we were going to go to Oxfordshire, and we weren't told where, because somehow, eventually, we turned up at Tame Park, STS-52, and we were told we were going to be transmitter hut attendants. And I remember saying to my friend Primrose, we said, good heavens, that doesn't sound very good. We could be cleaning the loos, you know. But anyway, we thought it was better than them saying a cook, because you could be anything.
Yeah.
They were really, according to what we were told, it was Churchill's secret army, and the fannies were the housekeepers. Mm-hmm. You know, they were admin, they were drivers.
Yeah. Although they're a volunteer corps now at this day, actually, then they effectively became part of the army.
Yes. I have a little contract from Horse Guards office somewhere signed, you know.
But let's go back to the transmitter hut attendant. What actually happened in those transmitter huts?
Well, Tame Park was very large. Mm. It was not only a training, but from 4 o'clock onwards till 11 at night, it was live. So that meant, you know, it was receiving messages from, say, France or Belgium. We were just told we were going to be trained for a few days, because if you wanted to be a wireless operator or coder, you had to be trained for considerably longer. It wasn't very difficult, but you had to be very precise, because the signal office in the large house would ring the transmitter hut, which was slightly up on a hill with vast masts all round it, rather like being in a garage in a way. And there were about four or six transmitters that had two dials, and you had to, you were rung up, given a frequency, and then at 10 to the hour, we had to tune them. And that was the where you had to be extremely precise. The needles would dip, and you knew. You're I can't right. remember, but I know that we stood there, and it was. And then when you tuned it, you rang the signal office back and said it was okay. And then when they'd, eventually we would hear Morse code coming through it.
And this, of course, was the SOE agents out in the field risking their life and
limb. And I mean, sometimes you didn't get it. You know, it would be all blank and there was no luck. But other times it didn't last very long, 10 minutes I'd say at the most. And of course the worst thing was if it suddenly went dead, because that usually meant, you know, they'd been found.
Compromised.
Because they had great difficulty. I mean, they were usually sitting up in safe houses with aerials hanging out of the window.
Yeah.
Or, you know, hidden
great,
stuff.
Great danger.
Yes.
Great risk of being found.
Absolutely.
And then suddenly the communication is cut. But you, when you
And we
heard
never
this.
Talked about it. It. You know, the next morning we'd see the coders all the while, and nobody, we never spoke about it. It's extraordinary how...
Never even to your girlfriend said...
No, we looked at each other very often. But, you know, we didn't say, oh, well, it sounds as if... Funny, I don't know why, we just didn't seem to talk about it. You know, we just got on to the next thing. We didn't know what all the stations did. I mean, they had to be parachuted, they had arms...
Commando training.
Yes, absolutely, everything. And, of course, the finishing school, which was at Bewley, where I think very often a lot was sifted out. They, far from everyone passed, you know, that went through, because they were interviewed, mock interviews by Germans, you know, and they had to get through or be woken up in the night, which I always thought was so difficult, to suddenly be woken up in the night and to find out who you were, because they didn't have their ordinary names. They all had code names.
And of course, at Tame Park, when you were there with them, you had all these young men and women going through training at the same time who didn't know who they were. How did it come forming relationships, forming friendships?
But you see, they might be there only for 3 weeks. They weren't long term. I think everyone knew they weren't long term, because there were the agents.
Yeah.
There was the army who were instructing them. They were mainly in the Royal Signals. And then there were the Fannies. Yeah. So it was quite a large, you know, no, it wasn't a camp, it was a wonderful house. But in actual fact, a few of our Fannies were in a small Victorian villa in Tame Village.
Was it a bit like being back at school in some sense?
Because I wasn't a boarder, it wasn't as comfortable in a way. But in fact, it was jolly cold and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Palliasse sort of mattresses.
And, so you need to explain a palliasse.
But it's a straw mattress.
And you had to change it, you had to pack it? How did you pack a palliasse mattress?
It must have been like being at school in a dormitory, because there were about eight of us, perhaps, in a room. But the other thing I always remember, Paul, that you never had two sheets. You just had one, you know, that folded over. So you sort of had to get into an omelet.
But the palliasse, when you first got into it, must have been quite crunchy the first night.
It was hot, and it was there was no spring. You know, it was not comfortable. And the blankets were so sort of rough.
Yeah.
But, you know, we were well fed, better than perhaps being in a large camp, because we were cooked by Fannies. Yeah. You know, in this particular house.
When you were allowed to bring, you had your pony Pinto.
Yes.
Who came to join. He must have been, that must be quite nice to write out on him.
Well, my mother had said, you see, where I lived at Oxford, it was in the flight path from Biggin Hill. So there were a lot of air raids. And she was very worried about being left with the horse in the field.
It wasn't just your pony, because you had Tiger, your Cairn Terrier.
He was the most popular thing, because I think I've always said, when I was on night duty and he was just left in the billet, the girls used to ask me, can we take Tiger to the pub? Always, because, you see, it was the best way of meeting someone.
Yes. And in the evenings, of course, there were gang shows, there was entertainment, and you were something of a soprano, I think.
Well, no, I know that's been talked about, but I did music at school. I wasn't very bright. Tennis was my best thing, and my mother was keen on music. So I learned the piano for a long time, the violin, and singing, which I didn't particularly thrilled about. But, you know, it was fun. And I believe my aunt had really quite a good voice. So, they thought I...
But in those days, singing was so much more common. Everybody did it much more.
And, like, you know, all the songs Vera Lynn was singing.
What was your favourite song of the time then?
Well, it was always usually Ivor Novello songs.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll Gather Lilacs.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they were all so melodious. The Nightingale sang in Berkeley Square.
Yes. by Ivor Novello especially, or by Vera Lynn?
Well, Vera Lynn, of course, the favourite. We all sang. She had some wonderful melodies.
What was your favourite of Vera Lynn's?
Well, I think actually the White Cliffs of Dover.
Yeah.
Tomorrow, just you wait and see. I'll never forget the people I met braving those angry skies. I remember well as the shadows fell, the light of hope in their eyes. And though I'm far away, I still can hear them say, thumbs up. For when the dawn comes up, there'll be bluebirds over the White Cliffs of Dover. Tomorrow, just you.
The White Cliffs of Dover, composed in 1941 by Walter Kent, with lyrics by Nat Burton, sung by the wonderful Dame Vera Lynn in 1942. You're listening to General Talk with me, Harry Bucknell, and my guest, former Fanny and SOE veteran, Joyce Wilding. As the war broke out, what precautions had you and your family taken should the Nazis have landed on Dover?
I do remember, because I was at school when it first broke out, we had a cellar in the house, which was wonderful, where we slept quite often, you know, if there was an air raid on. Funny enough, I don't know that we ever talked about what might happen. We always were... got the impression that you were told so little, even when we were in the fannies, because there was always that possibility that we might be invaded. Yes. I mean, it was really quite a possibility.
We are sitting here now in the lovely Sussex countryside, and it seems impossible, but when the bombs rained down, what was that like?
It was really rather nasty, because it was the sounds one always remembered, the air raid siren, and always the different sounds of our aeroplanes, the German planes, and of course then the doodlebugs, which you see, you were dreading, because you never knew when they were going to, land, because they cut out.
And Churchill took over, was there a great sense of, hurrah, now we've got the man who can do the job?
I think he, had so much more character and charisma. He was amazing, quite honestly. I think he pulled us through, really.
You had your own commanders and so on in the Fanny and the ATS were some quite remarkable women too at the same time. Who of your officers, the senior officers and your own officers, who really stood out, and why did they stand out for you?
Well, the headquarters ones, which I didn't work under, the Gamel sisters, who seemed to be quite well known, were wonderful at organising it. And it was really, they knew the two people, Colonel Buckmaster and Gubbins, Colin Gubbins, who formed SOE. I mean, it was slightly, I don't know, disorganized. Perhaps that was not doing it justice, but you know, it was amateurish in a way by very brave people.
Any sense of sort of antagonism between men and women? Was any, when did you experience any trouble being a lady in uniform?
No, no. I can't picture being it today, for instance, because it was amazing how quickly you made friendships, and you never thought of problems. I mean, I'm not saying there weren't, because I have a feeling if you were perhaps in a larger camp, things might have been different. But we were all concentrating on one particular aim, which was really to help the agents. And that's why I think we felt slightly special in a way.
Because you're part of the Special Operations Executive. We leave Thane Park and you then go on to Briggins and Station 14, which is really where all the great documents of the war, that the forged documents, the passes, the passports were there. You work very closely with some of these great documents, these great creators of art.
They produced all the identity cards.
275,000, wasn't it?
I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
This was more or less at the end of the war, you see.
Who were your comrades?
Well, I mean, in my little autograph book, they drew wonderful pictures because they very often were people that did advertisements. You know, they were all artists, but I'm not sure that they just drew pictures of people. They were extremely clever, and I believe there was even one chap they got out of prison who, you know, for fraud, because we didn't know who. There was two Nissen huts at Briggins, and all this work went on there. And I mean, I just thought they were wonderful. But they didn't tell us what they were doing, and we never saw inside the Nissen huts. But I would take, perhaps, for example, one of them, who obviously was a photographer, up to Kodak in East London to get special papers and things that he obviously needed for his work.
And you're driving a frightfully smart, huge shooting brake.
Yes.
American Ford V8 engine, aged 18. What was the great perk about that? Did you also enjoy trundling between Essex and Baker Street?
Yes, and I mean, I did it regularly, really. And of course, you know, I felt so grand when I went to a petrol station and filled up, you know, at that age, with everybody else rationed, and I could sign away this car and fill it up.
What was the key about Baker Street? Was it was your headquarters, wasn't it?
Yes, Norderby House, Baker Street, where Buckmaster and all the people. We didn't really know a great deal, just the drivers, except I would be delivering to a room number, room 68 or something. And perhaps I would be lent. The drivers very often were lent if they were short of cars in London, because it wasn't far to go. I'd have to drive somebody around London and take an agent perhaps to what they call safe houses, just before they were put somewhere for a couple of nights before they were sent off.
When you were with these young men and women, did you get a feeling of their sense of they were nervous about being deployed? Or were they very
nervous? I thought they were remarkable because they were all nationalities, Norwegian, Belgian. There were two guys from Mauritius, French-Canadian. You had to be obviously fluent.
Yeah.
And maybe have lived in the country.
Did you ever come across them again after the war?
No.
Never came across any of them?
No, only one, Fanny, which I didn't meet, but I happened to be at an event with my husband and talking to one of the men there. You know, I said I'd been in Thane Park. Oh, he said, my mother was there. And I found out that she actually, the mother was French and married an Englishman, you see, but she was obviously fluent. And she was an agent, and it's called Anne Knight. She was having tea in London and she dropped the book she was reading. This is how it happened.
Yeah.
And Buckmaster was also there. As far as I know, it was the Dorchester Hotel.
Yeah.
And he picked up the book and said to her, you know, I could do with you, or I could give you a very interesting job. And that's how she got involved.
Yeah.
And she must have perhaps gone to Tame, most of them went through Tame Park, and they were in Fanny uniform, because it was a good cover story for the girls.
I'd like to talk about as the tide of the war turned, so presumably one sort of confidence must have sort of come back a bit. Anime in 1943 with General Bernard Montgomery and his Eighth Army pushing through North Africa to D-Day. And you were back here in England in D-Day, and the build-up to D-Day with all the American troops and all the British troops gathering must be extremely exciting to be...
And, of course, all the Canadian troops which were in our fields, I believe they went all off. We didn't hear anything hardly from anyone after that. You know, there were great losses, I think.
When you left the Fannies, you transferred to British Red Cross in Bristol. What made you want to do that?
Well, because I didn't know. I thought, well, what am I going to do? Because I'd really enjoyed the company and the work and feeling that I was being useful. Because I hadn't gone to university, because I left school straight away. I hadn't learned to type, which most of the girls went, or you went to a school to learn cooking and how, you know, that kind of thing. So I found that the Fannies were still needing ambulance drivers in the West Country. I went there, and of course the British Red Cross Fannies had all been Fannies much longer than us SOE girls. And we were rather felt, I should say second best, but junior, if you know. I felt I was with senior, because they were all 30 years old. Some of them were married. And they didn't know what the SOE girls did.
No,
so they just thought we were really rather stupid, you know. But they didn't think we were important, because we weren't the originals in a way. I made some friends, but not for long. And I was with two older people in a lodge in Bristol, which with two ambulances and three drivers. So one week we had to clean the house and cook, and the other weeks we drove the ambulances. And that was mainly people that had been wounded, soldiers taking them to hospital and that type of thing. Or the other job was taking prisoners of war, which there was a camp, to work on farms. Bristol was terribly badly bombed.
Very badly bombed. What was it like come V-Day? That must have been a great party.
Well, that was before, of course.
Yes.
And I was in London, because I was at Briggins then. And all the Fannies, I think we went out with two cars. And, it was something I shall never forget, because we did the Hokey Cokey or the Pally Glide all the way down Piccadilly. And, I mean, it was just like this Platinum Jubilee. You couldn't see anything, because it was amazing. But there were masses of soldiers climbing up lampposts. And we went down, and in Piccadilly, you know, quite well-known restaurants, we had drink or something to eat. And then eventually we went round to the Mall and stood in front of Buckingham Palace. Because the Queen was then in uniform with Winston Churchill.
Do you remember the King coming out of the balcony?
Yes. Mm. And, you know, we did all the things that they always do, shout. It was the most joyous occasion.
Hostilities will end officially at 1 minute after midnight tonight. The ceasefire began yesterday to be sounded along all the fronts. The German war is therefore at an end. We may allow ourselves a brief period of rejoicing.
Off the war, did you miss that sense of purpose?
Well, in a way, I missed the feeling that we were really doing something rather useful.
Now you're involved very much as part of the senior echelons of the Fanny, the Princess Royal's Volunteer Corps. How is it going back to see the ladies doing their stuff?
Oh, it's amazing. And some of the women I met through it, you know, I've met one or two of the Bletchley girls, and also several ATS, because of this book that's been written, The Army Girls, it's brought a sort of lot of us together. And, you know, it, one thing has led to another.
Looking back on it all, 97 years on...
It's taken a long time.
What do you think, what was your favourite memory of those years?
I think I've got to say, really, VE Day. Being a fanny, driving up, you know, it was unbelievable. But actually, to be honest, I enjoyed being at Briggins, but partly because I was driving, which was much more interesting. But on the other hand, when I was tuning transmitters, I was nearer, in a way, to the agents. I had two very good jobs, I think.
Yes, I think you did.
But I was involved with two very... wonderful sort of organisation.
I think, Joyce, you're doing yourself down. Joyce Wilding, I'd like to say thank you so much for being my guest on General Talk today. It's been a real pleasure to talk
to
you.
Well, I have gone on a bit, but it's a great privilege, really.
And my thanks once again to Joyce Wilding for being such a wonderful guest. You can read about Joyce's time with the Armed Forces in Army Girls, Tessa Dunlop's book published last year, featuring stories and secrets of military service from the final few women who took part in the Second World War. Available from the bookshelf at ABF's online store, visit soldierscharityshop.org. That's soldierscharityshop.org. And from me, Harry Butnell, gently melting here in overheated Dorset, until next time, when I interview the new Chief of the General Staff, General Sir Patrick Saunders. Thank you for listening. Stay cool and farewell. We'll Meet Again, written and composed in 1939 by Ross Parker and Huey Charles, sung by Dame Vera Lynn. With editing by Steve Camper of Creative Radio, this has been a GameCube production for ABF, the Soldiers Charity.